This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 102 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I don't know why fans destroy their cities when their teams win championships, but they do. And Eagles fans did that on Sunday night. Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh, come on, not another person talking about how bad Philadelphia fans are. Wrong. I'm actually here to say that I'm really tired of the snobby attitude that fans have across the league as if their cities are so much better than Philadelphia. Back in 2009, the Steelers beat the Cardinals in the Super Bowl. It was an epic, epic game. I'm a Steeler fan, and I was in Pittsburgh when it happened. And I went out and I celebrated when they won the game. I had never experienced anything like that night in my life. There were aerial shots of different neighborhoods in the city, and you couldn't see the roads because they were just filled with people. It was absolute insanity. That night, I watched people push things into other people, I watched idiots break storefront windows, and I saw a group of people standing on top of a bus stop overhang fall over when that overhang collapsed. And then I'll never forget walking back to my apartment with my friends where we were going to enjoy some more adult beverages, looking to my left, and just seeing this car on fire. Just straight up on fire. Couches were burning, but cars were burning as well. I'm not excusing what some Philadelphia fans did on Sunday as an okay thing to do. Tearing down your city makes absolutely no sense. And yes, Philadelphia fans don't exactly have the best reputation. But let's stop the generalizations and let's stop this idea that they're the only city that's ever seen rioting after a championship win. It literally happens everywhere. I saw it happen with my own eyes. It's stupid. It makes no sense. But let's just relax for a minute and stop pretending like one fan base is flawless while the other one isn't. Because here's the dirty little secret. Fans kind of suck. Everywhere. Fandom is an amazing thing, and I'm all about the camaraderie and the good that can come of it. It brings communities together. There's nothing more enjoyable than watching your team win a championship. But there are bad apples in every fan base, man. There are people who get out of control, especially when they drink. Let's stop pretending it's only happening in Philadelphia, because I can assure you, it's not. Anyway, I saw that topic pop up on Twitter a lot this week, and I wanted to share my take, even though none of you guys asked for it. You did, however, ask for my take on a handful of questions for this week's mailbag, so let's dig in. This first one is from @GoPatsAndHuskies. JJ loved the Super Bowl podcast. Is there any evidence that the Browns coaches used analytics? How were Sashi and company using analytics in the front office? The only thing that we can confirm the Browns coaches used during the season was coloring books. I mean, seriously, that coaching staff consistently put the Browns in a position to fail, so I can't say that they used anything. To be fair, though, I remember a game between the Browns and the Titans in 2016 where the Browns scored to make the game 28-19 Titans with a little over 2 minutes to go, but the Browns still had to kick the extra point to make it an 8-point game. Then they would have had to recover an onside kick. Instead of kicking the point after touchdown, though, Cleveland opted to go for the 2-point conversion early, and they failed. So when they recovered the onside kick, everyone lost their minds. They could have had a chance to tie it up had they just kicked the extra point, people said. But we all know that there's not actually any difference in success rate for that 2-point try with 2 minutes left or 2 seconds left. You go for it earlier in the game because you want to have as much information possible to make smarter decisions. I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but if your chance of converting a 2-point conversion is the same no matter what, then there's no reason to go for it at the end of a game rather than 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes before the end of the game. At least if you fail with time remaining, you can adjust. You can make up for it. That was something that I guess was analytical, but that's also a stretch because it's kind of common sense. Hugh Jackson actually explained in a press conference last year too that he defers his choice to the second half during the coin toss because analytically, teams who defer usually get an extra possession. I'm sure he's used analytics, but I also would bet that it's not anything all that detailed. As for the front office, though, there are some very clear signs that the team's been using an analytics-heavy approach over the last two seasons, the most obvious being with the NFL draft. Analytical people are of the belief that the NFL draft is mostly random, or that you can't really beat the draft. You can find anecdotal evidence of teams beating the draft, but over the long run, it's a pretty random venture. That's why the Browns have traded down so much over the last couple of years. It's because players bust and having more picks increases your probability of hitting on a player. And Sashi and company have recognized that, so they'll get, say, an extra first rounder by trading out of the first and into the second. Especially when you're team building, doing that makes a ton of sense. I'm not sure how analytically heavy the team has been with player evaluation and acquisition. I think when people think about analytics in football, that's where their mind goes. It goes to player eval. But that's actually still a small piece to the larger puzzle. And like I said on the Super Bowl podcast earlier this week, analytics still wouldn't be making every single decision for you in the draft or via free agency. You've still got to use your eyes. This next one is from Zach. He says, thanks for all that you do. You've mentioned a few things that had me thinking a bit in your last two mailbag episodes. I'm in a 10-team, two-quarterback auction keeper league. We each keep two players with a max of 2 to 3 years we can keep a player. My question is, what do you do when you can keep a quarterback or tight end for a lot cheaper than expected market value? For instance, I can keep Travis Kelce for approximately $20 cheaper than he would be expected to go for. Do you still disregard this based off of the onesie position and opportunity cost? For instance, I would be passing on Adam Thielen for $20 to $30 cheaper or paying close to full market value for Kamara. Just would like to know how you approach auction keepers. Do you save the most money, pay up for elite guys, stay away from them, etc., etc.? Thanks. I think a lot of people go with the approach of comparing market value cost to the cost of their keeper, and whatever the largest discrepancy is in favor of the keeper, they then just keep that guy. That's not a bad approach. I mean, it's very logical. It's how people should be thinking about this. But my biggest argument against it as it pertains to the onesie position players, so tight ends and quarterbacks, is that the market value for those positions is probably inflated. Because market value doesn't factor in the things that I think are important for those positions, like the replaceability and supply and demand of those positions, which is why you draft them late. If the difference in keeper value to market value is substantially better than any other alternative, then sure, it's fine to keep a tight end like Travis Kelce. I'd argue against a quarterback pretty strongly, but tight end I can understand. But if it's close, then I would go with a wide receiver or a running back because they're simply more important in fantasy football, regardless of the individual player involved. We've got another keeper question, and this one is from Mike. He says, hi JJ, I have a keeper question. In the 12-team league I play, we keep three players each, but don't make those cuts until July. There's also no penalty or restrictions on the keepers. So with only 36 players kept prior to our draft, is making the keeper choice for my team as simple as looking at a top 36 average draft position list or ranking list? Or is there any unforeseen opportunity cost keeping top-tier running backs, or do you hang on to the David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, Todd Gurley, Ezekiel Elliott types? For example, I will keep three of Antonio Brown, David Johnson, Keenan Allen, and Adam Thielen. Is keeping David Johnson the obvious choice? Any other keeper thoughts for leagues that keep only several players per team? Mike, you're keeping David Johnson. If there's no value associated with each player and you can just keep guys straight up, ADP is fine to look at. Obviously, you may disagree slightly with ADP so you can adjust, but that's not a bad starting point to see the kind of value that you're holding. So in your case, you're more than likely just going to keep Antonio Brown, David Johnson, and Keenan Allen next year. This next one is from @Elliot_Metzger. This is somewhat fantasy related. The Eagles have Wentz, who is pacing for league MVP and Super Bowl MVP Nick Foles. Is this peak value for Nick Foles, and should the Eagles trade him? If so, do you see him making an impact anywhere in particular? I'm in the camp that the Eagles should trade Nick Foles. I understand the argument that having a backup quarterback is important, but I also am of the belief that Nick Foles' value right now is probably never going to be higher, considering he'll be sitting on the bench once Carson Wentz is back. The question is whether or not Wentz is back in time for the start of the season, and I cannot answer that. The Eagles have to weigh that, but if he is ready, then trading Foles makes sense. As you guys know, I love Nick Foles, but I also still view him as more of a bridge quarterback above a true franchise signal caller. So I could see him maybe in a place like Cleveland or maybe a team like Arizona as they look to find that quarterback. And I do still think that the best odds are actually for him to remain in Philadelphia. This next one is an email from Liam. He says, hey JJ, now that the big game is out of the way, it's time to start planning for fantasy football 2018, so I have a question about opportunity cost. You talk about the opportunity cost of taking an early round quarterback or tight end in the draft being that you miss out on the opportunity to take a higher value running back or wide receiver with those picks. I completely agree, but wondered to what extent you consider the implications of your strategy as it relates to the waiver wire during the season. The flip side of the late round quarterback and tight end approach is that there is an opportunity cost in needing to stream a quarterback and or a tight end during the season because you may need to prioritize the streaming of that position over going for a high impact running back or wide receiver from the waiver wire. When Dalvin Cook went down, for example, I had to decide between trying to pick up Latavius Murray or my top streaming quarterback choice, which happened to be Jameis Winston against the Patriots defense. If I had taken an earlier quarterback in the draft, then maybe I'd have been able to take Murray without worrying about my quarterback for that week. So I'm interested in whether you consider this element of the opportunity cost and how you decide what to do. Thanks for all the help, Liam. This is a question that I get a lot. And just to be straight up with you guys, I think some assumptions are being made each time I see or hear this question. You don't have to prioritize a quarterback or a tight end above a running back or a wide receiver off the waiver wire. In fact, if the running back or wideout is a hot commodity off the wire, you shouldn't be prioritizing a streaming option. In the majority of leagues, there's more than one streaming option at quarterback and tight end each week. And if there's not, then you should probably be going with more of a platooned approach in your league. And even if you get the option that you wanted, you're not guaranteed a top performance, so you shouldn't be going all in and using a high waiver wire priority on that player for a one-week rental versus a player who can potentially change your season. And the notion at the end of this question where you say, if I had taken an earlier quarterback in the draft, then maybe I'd have been able to take Murray without worrying about my quarterback for the week. That low-key drives me nuts. This is nothing against you, Liam. I'm sure you're a great guy. If you're ever in Charlotte, beers are on me. I'm just speaking from the heart and how the masses think about fantasy football. Because there's this idea out there that early round quarterbacks automatically do well. And it makes me want to rip my hair out. We know that's not the case, but people make it an assumption. And to be honest, that's why people draft early round quarterbacks each year despite the data heavily suggesting to do otherwise. So overall, please, I beg you guys, don't prioritize streamers when there are obvious running back and wide receiver options off the waiver wire that week. And don't buy into the narrative that quarterbacks can't bust or have bad weeks when you draft them early. This next one is from Twitter, at iPodShun. I'm in a two wide receiver, two running back, one wide receiver running back flex league. With the general de-emphasizing of running backs, do you think it would be a good idea to switch to two wide receivers, one running backs, and two flex instead? So I get the notion here, but I also don't know if this is the year something like this should happen. Running backs certainly aren't the same kind of running backs as we saw in 2008, but there are plenty to fill a two running back lineup. But I will say, I do like more flex spots because it allows people who understand and study the league better to perform better. So I'd probably lean that way regardless of the de-emphasizing of the position aspect. This next question says, hey JJ, what kind of league formats do you play and which is your favorite league and why? Adam. I kind of just mentioned it, but I like leagues that make owners digest the league settings and plan accordingly due to some interesting scoring rules. I don't really like scoring rules that are random, like an arbitrary bonus for a 300-yard game, but I like leagues where you get points for a first down or maybe a tight end premium format. And guys, super flex leagues are the way to go. There is no doubt about it. If you're not in one, try to get in one, or try to convince your league mates to change up the rules for your league to make quarterbacks more important. This last question is from my good friend Sigmund Bloom, at Sigmund Bloom. He says, is it worse to be a Pirates fan or a Browns fan right now? I figured I'd end with this question because it's more of a personal one for me, as I've been a lifelong Pirates fan and have lived through some of the worst teams I've ever seen in professional sports. But I thought about this question a good bit, and I think the answer is being a Browns fan. With baseball, a ton of franchises just don't have this expectation of winning a World Series. The Pirates had that 3 or 4 year window where it was a legitimate possibility a few years back, but with a small market baseball team, you know that window closes quickly and you're back to rebuild mode very fast. Not only is football more popular, so naturally if your team is bad, you're going to hear about it more, but teams can turn things around pretty damn fast. And the Browns haven't, over and over and over again. Plus, a lot of Pirates fans are also Penguins and Steelers fans who have won 5 total championships over the last 12 years. Cleveland's got 2 strong squads aside from the Browns, but it's not Penguins and Steelers strong. I feel for Browns fans, and I can kind of understand it as a Pirates fan, but I can't totally understand it. That's the last question for this week, though, guys. Thanks again for tuning in. If you've yet to subscribe to the show, please do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back in your ears next week.